Okay, now, again, before continuing with this, not only have the DuPonts and the Morgan Group attempted a coup in this country, their exposure in attempting to do that didn't back them off one bit. They proceeded to plunge wholeheartedly into the financing of American domestic American fascism. Continuing here, the attempt to launch Landon failed, which made the DuPonts hate Roosevelt even more. In outright defiance of Roosevelt's desire to improve working conditions for the average man, Knudsen of General Motors, along with the DuPonts, instituted the speed-up systems created by another prominent figure of the fraternity, Charles Bedeau, B-E-D-A-U-X. These forced men to work at terrifying speeds on the assembly lines. Many died of the heat and the pressure, increased by fear of losing their jobs at a time when there were very few available. Irenae personally paid almost $1 million from his own pocket for armed and gas-equipped stormtroops modeled on the Gestapo to sweep through the plants and beat up anyone who proved rebellious. He hired the Pinkerton Agency to send its swarms of detectives through the whole chemicals, munitions, and automobile empire to spy on left-wingers or other malcontents. By the mid-1930s, General Motors was committed to full-scale production of trucks, armored cars, and tanks in Nazi Germany. By the way, that's the mid-1930s. Continuing, the GM board could be guaranteed to preserve political, personal, and commercial links to Hitler. Alfred P. Sloan, who rose from president of GM to chairman in 1937, paid for the National Council of Clergymen and Laymen at Asheville, North Carolina, on August 12, 1936, at which John Henry Kirby, millionaire fascist lumberman of Texas, who was prominent in the delivery of speeches in favor of Hitler. Let me read that last sentence again. Alfred P. Sloan, who rose from president of GM to chairman in 1937, paid for the National Council of Clergymen and Laymen at Asheville, North Carolina, on August 12, 1936, at which John Henry Kirby, millionaire fascist lumberman of Texas, was prominent in the delivery of speeches in favor of Hitler. Others present, delivering equally Hitlerian addresses, were Governor Eugene D. Talmadge of Georgia, his son became a senator from that state, by the way, and the Nazi Reverend Gerald L. K. Smith. Remember the name Gerald L. K. Smith, we'll come back to him. Sloan frequently visited Berlin, where he hobnobbed with Goering and Hitler. Graham K. Howard was a vice president of General Motors. Under FBI surveillance throughout his whole career with the company, he was an outright fascist who wrote a poisonous book, America and a New World Order, that peddled the line of appeasement and a virtually identical doctrine to that of Hitler in terms of free trade and the restoration of the gold standard for the United States of fascism, in which General Motors would no doubt play a prominent part. Note that he refers to the United States of fascism here.
Yes, and bear in mind, this is the same General Motors they're talking about, of whom one of their presidents, one of GM's presidents, once said, "What's good for GM is good for America." Reading on, another frequent visitor to Germany was the rugged, cheerful, hearty James D. Mooney, head of the European end of the business, directly in charge of the Atom Opel production. On December 22, 1936, in Vienna, Mooney told U.S. diplomat George Messerschmitt, who, despite his German family origin, hated Hitler, quote, "We ought to make some arrangements with Germany for the future. There is no reason why we should let our moral indignation over what happens in that country stand in the way." In other words, although the mass of Americans despised the Nazis, business must continue as usual. Messerschmitt was furious. He snapped back, "We can hardly be expected to trade with a country only so that it can get those articles which it intends to use against the peace of the world," unquote. In a report of December 23rd to the acting Secretary of State in Washington, Messerschmitt wrote, quote, "It is curious that Mooney and Colonel Sosthenes Behn, B-E-H-N, both give this opinion. The factories owned by IT&T in Germany are running full-time and in double shifts and increasing their capacity for the simple reason that they are working almost entirely on government orders and for military equipment. The Opel works, owned by General Motors, are also working very well in the same way." That Christmas, Mooney was in Berlin for talks with Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schacht to discuss Germany's and America's joint future in the world of commerce. He attracted the hatred of the liberal U.S. ambassador to Germany, William E. Dodd, who returned from Berlin to New York in 1937, and referred to the fraternity, again, the author Haim's name for this grouping of industrialists, who referred to the fraternity in a shipboard press conference in New York Harbor. Dodd was quoted in the New York Times as saying, "A clique of U.S. industrialists is hell-bent to bring a fascist state to supplant our democratic government and is working closely with the fascist regimes in Germany and Italy. I have had plenty of opportunity in my post in Berlin to witness how close some of our American ruling families are to the Nazi regime. on the ship a fellow passenger, who is a prominent executive of one of the largest financial corporations, told me point blank that he would be ready to take definite action to bring fascism into America if President Roosevelt continued his progressive policies, unquote. Okay, now, again, we've talked, it may seem like we've branched off slightly in talking about participation of DuPont and GM with Nazi Germany and the Nazi war machine in Europe, but if you'll remember also, we started out talking about people like Wesley Swift and Richard Butler in Aryan Nations and William Potter Gale in Identity. And we mentioned the fact that William Potter Gale was on the staff of General Douglas MacArthur. We also mentioned that the GM and DuPont people tried to finance a coup d'etat attempt to take over the White House and either imprison or execute Franklin Roosevelt. And they approached Major General Smedley D. Butler to be essentially the American Hitler and lead the military to perform this coup. Now, these two trails, William Potter Gale and his later building up of the Identity Movement and the Morgan GM DuPont-sponsored coup attempt are going to start tying together.
Okay, now, remember that General Douglas MacArthur was reportedly involved in this plot to overthrow the government of the United States. Again, this was going to be a simple military coup. Now, Smedley Butler, who was the fellow who was picked to lead that plot, testified that MacArthur was involved with the plotters, although he did testify at one point that he wasn't sure if MacArthur was aware of the plans. Still, in many other times when he gave testimony, he implicated MacArthur directly in the plot. Now, one of the things that we're going to be looking at are some of MacArthur's connections. But again, remember Douglas MacArthur's role as basically the one of the proposed agents of the DuPont Morgan Financial Group here, okay, because that's an industrial group. That is essentially why we went into that particular group, to show that one of the most powerful alliances of financiers and industrialists in this country was openly pro-Hitler, as we've talked about in Uncle Sam and the Swastika, and that moreover they were willing to overthrow the democratic government of the United States and were very active in funding domestic fascism. Still more about the attempted coup in 1934. This is from a book called The Plot to Seize the White House by Jules Archer. It's copyrighted in 1973 by Hawthorne Books. The interview here is between Jules Archer and former Speaker of the House John McCormick, who was co-chairman of the McCormick-Dickstein Committee, the House committee set up to investigate the coup. Archer's interrogation or questioning of McCormick goes as follows. I asked McCormick what his own reactions had been to McGuire's testimony denying all of Butler's allegations. There was no doubt that General Butler was telling the truth, he replied. We believed his testimony 100%. He was a great, patriotic American in every respect. Skipping down, Jules Archer asks, had the plotters only wanted to take over the White House to restore the gold standard, or were they also out to destroy the New Deal and set up a fascist dictatorship to run the country through an American Mussolini? McCormick reflected a moment, then said, well, we were in the depths of a severe recession, and we had a good man, Roosevelt, in the White House, and he'd revived the hopes and confidence of the American people. The plotters definitely hated the New Deal because it was for the people, not for the moneyed interests, and they were willing to spend a lot of their money to dump Mr. Roosevelt out of the White House. Could you say definitely that the American Liberty League was the organization of big fellows that McGuire had described as being behind the plotters? I don't know anything about the Liberty League, he replied in a crisp manner that did not encourage me to pursue any further interrogation along that line. Mr. Speaker, why were the plotters so insistent that General Butler accept their proposal that he be the one to head the fascist march on Washington they planned? They chose Smedley Butler because they needed an enlisted man's general, not a general's general, unquote. They had to have a colorful figure, a half a million or more veterans who had been privates and non-coms would follow. General Butler was the most popular one. If General Butler had been an ambitious man like Aaron Burr and had been willing to be the man on the white horse for the plotters, do you think their conspiracy to take over the White House with all that money behind it might have succeeded? Well, if General Butler had not been the patriot he was, and if they'd been able to maintain secrecy, the plot certainly might very well have succeeded, having in mind the conditions existing at that time. Remember interrupting here that he says basically if Butler hadn't been of the orientation that he was, and if they had maintained secrecy, the plot would have succeeded. We're going to examine events that happened later and ask the question, did they succeed at a later date? Continuing. No one can say for sure, of course, but when times are desperate and people are frustrated, anything like that could happen. And we might have gone fascist. If the plotters had got rid of Roosevelt, there's no telling what might have taken place. They wouldn't have told the people what they were doing, of course. They were going to make it all sound constitutional, of course, with a high-sounding name for the dictator, and a plan to make it all sound like a good American program. A well-organized minority can always outmaneuver an unorganized majority, as Adolf Hitler did. He failed with his beer hall putsch, but he succeeded when he was better organized. The same thing could have happened here. So, again, that this, despite the denials from the people who were involved, there was a very, very real attempt at a fascist coup in the United States in 1934, backed by some of the most powerful and most prominent members of American society, whose firms, whose the industrial and financial firms that they worked through, dominate the United States today. Firms like General Motors, DuPont, the Morgan Bank, and so forth. Of course, we've looked at that in connection with the funding of Nazi Germany. The point is that this same group was ready, willing, and able to establish fascism in the United States.
Okay, from a little further on in the plot to seize the White House, this is a transcription of, not a transcription, but it's a, well, I can't think of the term right now, but basically it's a literalization of the testimony of Major General Smedley D. Butler when he was talking about his conversations with Gerald McGuire, this attorney who contacted Butler on behalf of the, quote, fraternity, as author Charles Higham had had it in the other book, as this author had had it. Anyway, so this is not the translation, which we have, too, but this is just the author's putting this into expository form. But that's the Butler that he's referring to is Major General Smedley D. Butler, who at this point is leading the attorney, Gerald McGuire, on about what this organization can do and will do. There was only one Morgan in the financial world. The attorney has just referred to backing from Morgan, J.P. Morgan and Company. McGuire left no doubt in his mind, Butler's mind that is, that the nation's biggest financiers were indeed involved. According to the bond salesman, there had been a meeting in Paris to decide upon the selection of the man to head the superorganization. McGuire and his group had held out for Butler, but the Morgan interests distrusted the general as, quote, too radical, preferring Douglas MacArthur instead. MacArthur's term as chief of staff expired in November, and the Morgan interests felt that if Roosevelt failed to reappoint him, he would be bitter enough to accept their offer. Butler observed that MacArthur would be likely to have difficulty in lining up veterans behind him because his dispersion of the Bonus Army had made him highly unpopular. The Bonus Army was, of course, the army of World War I soldiers who were not getting the pensions that they felt were due to them and marched to Washington en masse in a peaceful protest, and Douglas MacArthur took a bunch of troops out at the order of, I believe it was Coolidge, but I could be wrong. No, it was Hoover, and dispersed these unarmed American veterans who just wanted their pension benefits. McGuire, again the attorney, indicated that the Morgan coterie's second choice was Hanford McNider, an Iowa manufacturer who was a former commander of the American Legion. But McGuire emphasized that his own group was still insisting that Butler was the only military leader in the country capable of rallying the veterans behind him. The Morgan interests had acknowledged Butler's immense prestige and popularity, he revealed, but were apprehensive that as head of the paramilitary force, Butler might lead it in, quote, the wrong direction. Butler observed that McNider would have no more popular appeal than MacArthur, because he had gone on record as opposing the Bonus. McGuire then revealed that McNider would be cued to change his stand, and would do so. Butler remembered this prediction when, 3 weeks later, McNider suddenly reversed his position and came out in support of the Bonus. Okay, so inserting this quickly, McGuire is claiming to have this internal control and to know what's going on behind the scenes and letting Butler in on how well connected these men are and how good they are at manipulating things. They're saying, Butler says McNider would not be a popular leader because of his opposition to this Bonus for World War I veterans who were all of them out of work because of the Depression. And McGuire tells him that's all right, McNider's going to reverse that position, presumably to make himself more popular in case he did wind up being the contingency leader of this coup d'etat. If Butler could not be persuaded to head the new superorganization, McGuire said, the offer would definitely be made to MacArthur, whether or not the latter was reappointed chief of staff. He confided that there would be an administration fight over MacArthur's reappointment, but he would get it, meaning MacArthur would get the appointment, because he was the son-in-law of Philadelphian Edward T. Stotesbury, a Morgan partner, Stotesbury, S-O-T-E-S-B-U-R-Y. It was a bold prediction, since never before in American history had a chief of staff been allowed to succeed himself. Butler was all the more startled and impressed with McGuire's sources of information when his prediction came true several months later.
Okay, now, the connection here that's really, really important is the fact that General Douglas MacArthur, whose staff we're going to look at great length and connect up with all of these fascist groups here and connect up with fascist machinations for about a 50-year period from the early 30s to the present time. Basically, Douglas MacArthur was an in-law of a very prominent member of the Morgan Financial and Industrial Group, a man named Edward T. Stotesbury. I'd like to read you a little piece of information now from a book called 1,000 Americans. That was a book authored by a very famous anti-fascist writer named George Seldes, last name S-E-L-D-E-S. We've used his work before on this program. And 1,000 Americans by Seldes was published in hardcover by Bonnie and Gair, B-O-N-I and G-A-E-R, copyrighted 1947. Now, one of the last things in this book is a table which basically documents the amount of money contributed by various key American industrialists and financiers to various domestic American fascist organizations. And under the S section, we find under Stotesbury, E.T., recall the father-in-law of General Douglas MacArthur, a contribution of $1,000 to a fascist group called the Sentinels. And remember that $1,000 was a lot more in the 1930s than it is now. But MacArthur's father-in-law, Stotesbury, not only is connected to the Morgan Financial Group, but was an active financer of fascist causes at times. And remember that MacArthur was the first choice of the Morgan DuPont fascist plotters to replace Roosevelt by heading up this veterans group. However, they felt that MacArthur did not have the requisite popularity. So we're beginning to see how MacArthur fits into this thing. Again, we're not impugning Douglas MacArthur directly, nor are we excusing him. As we say, if he was not a doctrinaire fascist, he has to have been one of the stupidest men of all time because he allowed some outright and outspoken fascists to surround him and to operate much of the military apparatus that was underneath him. So, again, if he was not himself a doctrinaire fascist, he must be regarded as one of the great incompetents of all times, at least from a political standpoint.
Okay, at this point, we're going to take a short break for maybe 5, 6, 7, or 8 minutes, depending on how long we feel like we need to take a break for. Just to let you know that these things aren't carving in stone here in the wonderful world of radio broadcasting. But we will be taking a break, and we will be back to continue on with this line of inquiry and some other things. And we're about halfway through the information portion of the program, more or less. And if we do have time tonight, we will go to the back to Radio Free America. This is Nip Tuck in the studios at KFJC with Dave Emery. We're going to be here until 11 o'clock, and we're well into the broadcast here. Fade the music out there in the background. Just in case you're curious, that was, of course, The Clash with Guns on the Roof and Jimi Hendrix, the late, the great, with House Burning Down, rather appropriate in view of Posse Comitatus and Gordon Call and all those other cats. Anyway, we're going to be continuing on now, as you will, to briefly recap, very briefly recap, some of the things we were talking about. Again, we outlined some major groups. We started out with a quick overview and discussion of Aryan Nations. This is the group headed by Richard Butler out of the Hayden, Idaho area. Richard Butler is a protege of Wesley Swift. Wesley Swift. Reverend. They're all reverends. These guys all have Christian ministries, or seem to anyway, probably for tax purposes of some kind, unless maybe they really do believe that because they're appointed by God that they ought to at least have the official title. Okay, the other name that we mentioned and that was sort of the springboard for this next part that we've been working on and will continue on for a little while was a band by the name of Potter Gale. Potter Gale was Colonel William Potter Gale was a member of General Douglas MacArthur's staff in Korea, I mean in the Philippines, and left the army at age 33, founded the Identity Movement. The Identity Movement, we heard one right-winger refer to as being the umbrella organization that a bunch of other Nazi and Klans members really are part of, whether they acknowledge it or not. We then went on to discuss a coup attempt that was undertaken on behalf of several financiers connected with Morgan Guarantee and Trust Company, with DuPont, the owners of GM, and their initial approach to General Smedley Butler, who happened to be the kind of guy who thought that that was treason and went and reported it to Franklin Roosevelt, who was president at the time. And the fact that, among other things, the attorney, Gerald McGuire, who initially contacted Butler on behalf of these financiers, gave Butler to believe, as he said later on, that Douglas MacArthur was in on the plot. It has since been stated that MacArthur was not on the, in on the plot by Butler himself, or he has seemed unsure of it. But as Dave mentioned, MacArthur will have to be proven by history to be incredibly short-sighted to have not realized some of the things going on right under his nose. We mentioned, of course, Potter Gale and his fascist leanings. Not leanings, his driving fascist passions, which led him to found the Identity Group. And as we go along, we're going to talk about some other people who are on MacArthur's staff.
Okay, now remember that the MacArthur staff and the Morgan Financial Group and our industrial group are what we're really looking at here, and that Douglas MacArthur, that they're connected, because basically Douglas MacArthur is the son-in-law of a key Morgan operative, Edward T. Stotesbury, who was also of fascist sympathies and was willing to back those fascist sympathies with some money, okay?
All right, now the next section we're going to read is from a book entitled MacArthur in Korea, subtitled The Naked Emperor. It's by Robert Smith, copyright 1982 by Simon & Schuster. Okay? Now, again, he's going to be talking about several of MacArthur's associates, and you can make up your own mind whether we're being perhaps a little over-hasty in labeling MacArthur's staff as being rife with fascists. Major General Courtney Whitney, Smith writes, MacArthur's most intimate associate and the only one of his staff who was allowed to walk unannounced into the spacious office in the Dai-ichi building where MacArthur concealed himself, made no secret of his anti-Semitism, which would hardly have been termed, quote, benign, nor is it possible that it could have been unobserved by MacArthur. Once, when Whitney sat with a group of strangers in the smoking compartment of a New York to Washington Pullman, there was talk about MacArthur, in which one traveler, an ex-Navy man, offered a belittling comment about Whitney's boss, without knowing, of course, just what Whitney's connection was. After eliciting an unexpectedly angry rejoinder, the man who made the remark left the compartment. Whitney, his eyes still ablaze, turned to those remaining. Quote, "He must be a kike," he cried. Jews, one had to assume, were the natural enemies of MacArthur. This was certainly the doctrine of another of MacArthur's oldest and most trusted friends, Major General George Van Horn Moseley, who served as MacArthur's deputy during MacArthur's term as Army Chief of Staff. In 1943, when MacArthur's ambition to become president first began to stir, Moseley, self-appointed political advisor, wrote MacArthur, warning him that the, quote, "Jews and un-Americans are hoping that the president, Franklin Roosevelt, may run, but they are taking no chances. I understand that they are supporting Wilkie with all kinds of money, so that if he should be elected, they will still be in the saddle. In my opinion, Wilkie has turned out to be a contemptible individual. When he was first discovered, everyone felt, I believe, that an able, honest businessman had been found. Then he sold out to the vicious elements now in control," unquote. Moseley invariably lumped Jews and un-Americans together, as he did, quote, "labor and communists." MacArthur's response to this letter was that it contained, quote, "much food for thought."
Remember the name George Van Horn Moseley, because we're going to focus on him at great length here in a little while. We're going to see him as one of the central figures in another proposed fascist coup, an attempt simply to eliminate or perhaps even murder Roosevelt and put him out of office or murder him and establish a fascist government in this country in active cooperation with Nazi Germany. Moseley will be involved in that later. Right now we're going to look at some more charming fellows that MacArthur had on his staff. One of the most important is a guy named General Charles Willoughby. Continuing now from MacArthur in Korea by Robert Smith. Nor is it unfair to note the fact that there was not a single member of MacArthur's inner circle who could be identified as broad-minded on the matter of race. The third man closest to MacArthur was Charles Willoughby, W-I-L-L-O-U-G-H-B-Y, his German-born intelligence chief. And Willoughby made it clear to anyone who would listen that next to MacArthur, he deeply admired Francisco Franco as a leader and a soldier, perhaps the second greatest who ever lived. Whether his admiration extended to Franco's dear friend, ally, and role model, and Willoughby's own fellow countryman Adolf Hitler is too late to discover. But it at least seems not unlikely. We're going to talk more about Charles Willoughby and what his real name is and some of his political connections in a second, continuing here with Robert Smith's narrative. How was it, then, that MacArthur ever earned a reputation as a liberal as well as a liberator? When required at last to step down from his pedestal, discard his role as semi-deity, and finally articulate his real convictions in his campaign of 1951, He revealed himself as a mediocre, long-winded, and strident political hack out of another century who proposed to repeal the income tax amendment, cancel out all other such socialist, unquote, policies, and save us all from economic incompetence, unquote, by putting big business back in the saddle. Sounds exactly like what the fascist plotters in 1934 were trying to do, reportedly involving MacArthur. Even in his reminiscences, completed in 1964, he continued to assail the Marxist-inspired, unquote, federal income tax law of 1914, the process of controlling economic conditions, unquote, and the government's incessant encroachment upon the capitalist system, unquote. Phrases which don't sound too very much different from people in power today, and worth noting also that the vehement opposition to the income tax here, that is also reminiscent of the posse comitatus, just worth noting here.
Okay, a little earlier in that same article, it mentions Van Horn Moseley sending him a copy of a book by an acquaintance, a reverend acquaintance of Van Horn Moseley's, stating that that Harry Truman was a Zionist and was probably was he a Jew himself? He hung out with Zionists, et cetera, and explained that the Zionists were led by the protocols of the elders of Zion to try and seize world power. I mean, this is the kind of absolute Nazi lunacy that the protocols of the elders of Zion is a famous ploy on the behalf of the white Russian Secret Service to slander the Jews, and it was used by the Nazis, and virtually any time it crops up somewhere, you can almost guarantee that the person using it is beyond any sort of normal, sane approach to anything remotely resembling contact between different racial groups. And the fact that this was sent to MacArthur, and MacArthur stuck it on his bookshelf, it says, and it was it's still to this day sitting in the MacArthur Library. Looks like a great little book.
The reason we're perhaps belaboring some of this in the eyes of some of you is that, again, we're dealing with a very widely known and widely mythologized American figure, MacArthur. We're also dealing with people who are not only very well known but very famous and whose names, as I say, dominate American life today. DuPonts, General Motors, and so forth. These are major elements in American life. And when we say fascist, we're not banding the term around lightly. We're using the term advisedly. We mean doctrinaire Nazism and... Well, we're going into some of this at the length we're doing in order to illustrate that, because again, we assume that the burden of proof is on us here, and these people are so venal and so unabashedly fascistic that I think it's easy enough to see. But again, that's why we're going into some of this stuff, because these are not people who most Americans are accustomed to thinking of as fascists, and they were.
Okay, another intimate of MacArthur's, Major General Charles A. Willoughby. Charles A. Willoughby was, among other things, a rather interesting man that, among other things, he professed some great admiration for some rather interesting people. The section that we're going to be reading is from an article from The Reporter for August 19th, 1952. Research credit to Mae Brussel for this. The article is written by Frank Kluckhohn, K-L-U-C-K-H-O-H-N. I have no idea if I'm pronouncing that correctly. And at this point, he's talking about a visit recently made, as of the time this article was written in 1952, by Charles Willoughby to Franco's Spain at the time, his encouragement of Franco's demand for lots of money because of his anti-communist stance. And Willoughby is very enamored of Spain, refers to it as a, quote, cradle of supermen. Anyway, going on to read from this article from The Reporter, August 19, 1952. Those who knew something of Willoughby's background were not greatly surprised at his paying these sudden attentions to Generalissimo Franco. John Gunther has reported that while he was gathering material for his book, The Riddle of MacArthur, he was at dinner one evening with Willoughby when the general suddenly proposed a toast to, quote, the second greatest military commander in the world, Francisco Franco, unquote, MacArthur obviously being the greatest. Willoughby told one Madrid audience that the U.S. Army Command and General Staff School he had lectured in favor of Franco as early as 1936. After he had given an impassioned account of his pro-Franco sentiments at a phalangist luncheon in Madrid, Willoughby was toasted by Fernandez Cuesta, Secretary General of the Phalangist Party, in these words, quote, I am happy to know a fellow phalangist and reactionary. General Willoughby has been described by an exceptionally candid Japanese who once worked with him in Tokyo as a, quote, stout, obdurate German-American officer like a bull. He has sharp brains and nerves which bring about once in a while a sudden burst of temper. But on the other hand, he is also a diplomatic person, unquote. Willoughby has been more succinctly described by a fellow officer as, quote, our own Junker general. And, of course, the Junkers were the Prussian aristocracy. In the biographies Willoughby has provided to the Army and to Who's Who in America, he is described as having been born in Heidelberg, Germany on March 8, 1892, the son of Freiherr, which means Baron, T. von Scheppe Wiedenbach, and of Emma von Scheppe Wiedenbach, nay, Emma Willoughby, of Baltimore, Maryland. Excuse me, I've got so many WVs there, I'm losing track. Anyway, so once again, Willoughby, toasted by the head of the Falangist Party as a fellow Falangist and a reactionary, a great believer in Francisco Franco, and another intimate of MacArthur. And Dave is going to tell you a little bit more about this interesting character.
Recall now that Franco basically came to power with active assistance from Hitler and Mussolini and was very, very close to them ideologically and politically as well. We'll look at Franco in a program about the rise of fascism. But it's worth noting here that Willoughby was not only German-born and fascist-oriented, but he appears to have been perhaps a doctrinaire fascist himself, in as much as he was an avid fan of Francisco Franco. In a past One Step Beyond broadcast, a listener phoned in and from a book called The Alliance by Richard Barnett, read a short section which basically revealed that Willoughby had attended the Kriegswehr Academy, the German military academy, and graduated in 1934. In doing some of the research for this broadcast, we were unable to, we secured a paperback edition of the book. The index, at least Willoughby's indexed references, did not reveal that particular information, but, you know, books do make mistakes, and perhaps this particular reference was not indexed. At any rate, we will continue to look for that, and if we can get a hold of that information for our next broadcast in the series, we'll relay it to you. But according to The Alliance by Richard Barnett and a section read by a listener to this broadcast, to our One Step Beyond broadcast on the air, Willoughby actually received part of his military education at the German Military Academy, graduating in 1934, a year after Hitler came to power. Now, one of the interesting things about this Falangist connection, the Falange basically being the fascist party of Spain, founded and headed by Francisco Franco. One of the interesting things about this is that throughout the Spanish-speaking world, in particular the few remaining colonial properties remaining to Spain at that time, in fact I'm not sure if they actually had any colonial properties, but their neo-colonial properties, the Falange was very, very influential throughout Latin America. Wherever the Spanish language and culture existed, the Falange, Franco's fascist party, established overseas branches. Well, one of the places that was a former Spanish colony and retained a very large degree of Spanish influence even after it formally became independent from Spain was the Philippines. Now, in the Philippines, there was a very prominent Falange group, a Spanish fascist group allied with Hitler, and this group in Spain, in the Philippines rather, was headed up by a man named Andres Soriano, last name S-O-R-I-A-N-O. He was a prominent Philippine industrialist of Spanish extraction, and his best-known commercial enterprise was San Miguel Beer, which many people are familiar with. Anyway, Andres Soriano became General Franco's representative in the Philippines and later became a colonel on MacArthur's staff after MacArthur went back to the Philippines, after he returned, unquote, to the Philippines, and Willoughby apparently was the fellow who set this connection up. Returning again to the reporter from August 19th of 1952, General MacArthur met Willoughby when the latter was a captain teaching at Fort Leavenworth in the mid-1930s and was, according to legend, greatly impressed by him. In 1940, MacArthur, then serving as Field Marshal of the Philippine Commonwealth, sent for Willoughby and made him his supply officer and then his assistant chief of staff for intelligence. So basically Willoughby became, at this point, he's his assistant chief of staff for intelligence. Willoughby became MacArthur's intelligence chief. Remember that because of his fascist orientation. Willoughby was running all of the intelligence for Douglas MacArthur throughout the entire course of the Second World War and later in Korea. Interesting, in light of his fascist connections, fascist sympathies, and so forth, that he was basically running MacArthur's intelligence. Continuing here with the reporter's account. In Manila, Willoughby, who had shown a great affinity for genteel Hispanic atmosphere while an attaché in Latin America, began spending more and more time around the Spanish club. Its members were mostly Spaniards who had been born in the Philippines but had chosen to maintain their allegiance to the motherland rather than to the new Commonwealth. the families that dominated the club controlled most of the wealth of the islands. Moreover, fully 80% of them were ardent Francoists and active Falangists. The most formidable names were those of the Sorianos, Elizaldes, Brias Rojases, and Zobels, who among them held most of the strings of Philippine business and banking. Before long, Willoughby became known as the close friend of Andres Soriano, the Spanish club's most influential member and one of the richest men in the Philippines. Soriano was not only Willoughby's friend, he was also the good friend of General MacArthur and of another principal MacArthur assistant, Major General Courtney Whitney, who before the war was a lawyer and promoter in Manila. Courtney Whitney was the fellow who unleashed that anti-Semitic diatribe at the beginning of the section Nip read you from MacArthur in Korea. Van Horn Moseley, by the way, also was of similar sentiments. Soriano had, and still has, mining interests, breweries, airlines, shipping, radio stations, textiles, jute plants, and the Philippine concessions for the products of many great American firms. During the Spanish Civil War, Soriano was the principal Franco supporter in the Philippines, making large contributions to the Falangist cause, serving as Franco's honorary consul general in Manila, and receiving the highest Franco decorations. Just before Pearl Harbor, it was felt in Manila not only that war was imminent between Japan and the United States, but that Franco would be in it, too, on the side of the Axis. In that event, Spanish holdings in the Philippines would certainly be impounded. Soriano rushed to divest himself of the Spanish citizenship he had hung on to so long and so proudly. The Civil Liberties Union of the Philippines contested in court his application for Philippine naturalization, holding that because of his previous political activities, Soriano did not meet the requirements. Soriano, however, was quickly and quietly granted his papers. When the Japanese attacked, Soriano volunteered and became a captain in the Philippine Army. He was at Bataan and Corregidor and left the Philippines by plane with President Quezon, Quezon, shortly after MacArthur and Willoughby made their memorable dash to Australia by PT boat and plane. Although he had been a Philippine citizen for only a few months, Soriano, who shortly thereafter arrived in Washington with Quezon, was named by the latter to serve as Secretary of Finance in the Philippine government in exile. There was criticism on the floor of Congress from Democratic Representative John Coffey of Washington about such a pronounced Francoist and fascist being a member of a U.S.-supported allied government while the United States was at war with the fascist powers, and there were calls for Soriano's resignation. At this point, Soriano received an invitation from MacArthur's headquarters in Australia to join the staff immediately as a colonel. Although Secretary of the Interior Harold Ickes, I-C-K-E-S, protested to Secretary of War Henry Stimson about the appointment, Soriano took the post, was with MacArthur and Willoughby in the triumphant return to the Philippines, and presently found himself serving the Supreme Commander as one of his two principal advisors on Philippine politics and business. According to one of his American fellow officers in Manila, who was responsible for investigating collaborationist charges, Soriano was able on occasion to use his position to protect some of the old friends in the Spanish club who had survived the Japanese occupation remarkably well. So, again, Francisco Franco was a doctrinaire fascist assisted by Mussolini and Hitler in overthrowing the Spanish government and was sort of a passive Axis collaborator. Although Spain did not actually enter the war militarily, it served as an espionage base and as a communications base for the Axis powers. And Andres Soriano, Franco's representative in the Philippines, became a colonel and a key advisor on MacArthur's staff and was also very friendly with Willoughby, Courtney Whitney, and some of the other fascists on MacArthur's staff.
Okay, we're going to go on and talk a little bit about a man that we mentioned earlier, Van Horn Moseley, George Van Horn Moseley, general on MacArthur's staff, the one who was sending MacArthur the letters talking about the Jews and un-Americans and labor and communists and things of that nature and how Wendell Willkie had sold out to the Jews and un-Americans and et cetera, et cetera. Van Horn Moseley is another one of these gentlemen who could be called at best a spotty history. And we're going to read a little bit about him from American Swastika. This is a book I mentioned earlier that's the new book by Charles Higham, the man who wrote Trading with the Enemy that we quoted from at some length earlier.
By the way, both of these books are available right now. The information comes to you. You can find this information in a lot of different books. One of the reasons we're putting it on the air from these books is that these books are current and you can go out and get them.
That's right. And the hardback of American Swastika we have is from Doubleday and Company, Garden City, New York, 1985, just in case you were wondering. Charles Higham again is the author. Okay, now the man that they're going to be referring to in this next segment as Detheridge is George Detheridge, a West Virginia brewer and a confirmed pro-Nazi activist, a person who published lots of Nazi propaganda, had contacts himself with German propagandists and people of that nature, and among other people was also in contact with Van Horn Mosley, who again was a general on MacArthur's staff and a good friend of Douglas MacArthur, wrote him lots of letters, was one of the people urging him to run for president to save the country from the Zionists and the communists, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, but Detheridge is the West Virginia brewer slash fascist. Detheridge kept in close touch with Berlin and with Ulrich von Gienanth, military attaché at the German embassy in Washington. This is about 1936. When Detheridge asked von Gienanth how Hitler got started, the military officer told him that it was also with a small amount of money, a brewery headquarters, and propaganda leaflets. In other words, just like Detheridge. Von Gienanth made clear that the German government disapproved of the German-American Bund because of its flagrant public activities. He encouraged Detheridge to follow a policy of developing anti-Jewish feeling, saying there was 10 times more of that in the United States than there was in Germany before Hitler's rise to power. Both von Gienanth and Hans Luther of the German embassy visited Major General Mosley and discussed coming prospects with him. Detheridge felt that there was an advantage in encouraging the Bund, because its scores of thousands of members could be enlisted in the counter-revolution. At lunch with the Bund's Fritz Kuhn at the Harvard Club in 1938, Kuhn pledged him 500 Bund groups. Detheridge grew bolder as World War II approached. He began writing speeches for Mosley and circulating propaganda directly through Mosley's clubs and army affiliations. Although Mosley apparently had doubts about heading up a counter-revolutionary government, he did not hesitate to deliver anti-Semitic speeches of Detheridge's authorship well into 1939. Bear in mind that this had been already about 6 years of Jews being rounded up in Germany, and Van Horn Mosley is giving Detheridge's speeches, and Detheridge is getting his speeches directly from German propagandists. On December 29, 1938, Mosley regurgitated a Detheridge address in Indianapolis. It was a virtual repetition of an earlier speech he had given at the New York Board of Trade, which had been cheered by the assembled bankers and industrialists. He began his speech with a lie, that he had no ghostwriter. He charged all liberals with being radicals and communists. He talked of an unlimited right to carry arms, as the pioneers did, but he said that, quote, communists, CIOs, and murderers must not be allowed to carry weapons. He said, quote, remember that in all history, before an internal enemy attempts to destroy his victim, he first disarms him by the operation of law,